Today's program was brought to you by EscapeMaker.com. Visit a farm, escape through the net. Visit EscapeMaker.com for more.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, and welcome to A Few Things with Claire and Erica, where we just tell you about everything that we're obsessed with lately.
Pretty much.
Yeah. We're professional enthusiasts, so...
Or that's our goal, at
that's
least.
That's our goal in life,
the target.
Where we grow up, basically. And we have a website called Of A Kind. Visit it at www.ofakind.com.
On that website, we sell the pieces and tell the stories of emerging fashion designers and home designers. And then we also send a weekly Monday newsletter called 10 Things that basically rounds up all of our favorite discoveries that aren't really related to the things that we are writing about and selling on the site. And that is what this here podcast is inspired by.
True facts. So
true
sign
facts.
Up at ofakind.com.
I'm Erica.
I'm Claire. We're business partners.
Yes.
Podcast co-hosts.
And friends.
Multitaskers.
So we have a return guest coming up soon. Our first return guest, Lauren Sherman. We're bringing her back because she has so many interesting things to say. And in the meantime, we are going to talk about sunscreen.
So important.
Yeah.
All year round, especially this time of year.
Yeah, we don't want to make it seem like this is like a seasonal thing that, oh, all of a sudden because it's July, we're talking about sunscreen, because that's not the truth.
But people do think about it more this time of year. I certainly do.
Yeah.
I run outside most days, and I think about, and like, even take away all the time I spend just like walking to the subway or wherever else, because I spend a lot of time just indoors. That's half an hour every day of sun exposure that is like really
needed to be accounted for.
Really adds up out over time. And I wouldn't even consider myself somebody who has super sensitive skin, because I don't have a lot of weird skin allergies. But my entire life, I've always gotten bumps from any sunscreen I put on my face. I like break out into a weird dry rash. And so for a really long time, I just didn't wear sunscreen on my face, even though I knew it was the thing
to do.
That
you're meant to. Yeah.
And I mentioned this one time on our site or in 10 Things or something like that. And I got all these like tweets and emails from other people who are like, me too, which made me feel so good, because I was like, it's such a weird thing. I'm not allergic to most things. It's a specific sunscreen thing. And over the last couple of years, I have found a couple sunscreens that don't give me rashes, which is really exciting for me.
Okay, so what are those
sunscreens? Well, the first one you introduced me to.
Yeah.
And it's the Peter Thomas Roth SPF powder. And it's
in a brush.
Yeah, it's in a brush. It's one of those cool brushes where it's like the powder's in the handle of the brush.
Yep.
So you just kind of like shake the brush and the powder comes out. And so for a while I was like, this is fine. This is enough. It's great because it's almost like a powdery foundation or like a setting powder.
Because
it has a little bit of color to it. So it kind of like, you feel like it pulls your whole face beauty look together.
They used to have a sheer one or a colorless one that I think they've discontinued, unfortunately, for people who don't want the tint or
it's like a sheer tint.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's nice. It's like, it's funny because I love the Josie Maran, the Laura Mercier tinted moisturizer, which like people swear by. It's a cult classic. I could never wear it because it has SPF in it and it made me break out. But this Peter Thomas Roth is a great substitute for it. But then,
well, it's also a great thing just to keep in your bag if you're accidentally getting sun exposure. If you like end up, you know, having lunch outside or something, and you can dust it on your sort of nose and shoulders and anything that's exposed that you didn't cover up in the morning before you left the house.
Totally.
It's not a mess. You don't get it all over your hands.
Yeah, no, it's so easy. It's so quick. But then when I mentioned it to somebody, to our friend Rena, who's like also a beauty obsessive like us, she was like, what are you doing, Claire? Haven't you read all the articles? That is not enough. It's not full coverage. And I was like,
it's a good
damn.
Sort of secondary thing.
So that burst my bubble over that discovery. But then recently, a couple of all pretty new lines have come out in the last couple of years, all of which work for me and don't give me rashes. So the first is Restore C, which is in general just a great skincare line by our friend Patty Powell, who's a business genius and a beauty genius. The other is Beauty Counter, which is also a brand new all-natural skincare line out of Los Angeles or Santa Monica.
Yes.
And the other one is Super Goop, but it's specifically the Super Goop skin soothing formula.
That's the one that you like.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's made with like olive oil, polyphenols or something like that.
I also just recently purchased the Super Goop Setting Mist, which is one of their brand new products. And it's another one of these things that you spray on afterward. I don't know if I totally buy into the fact that it's covering my whole face when I spray it on, but it is SPF 50. So telling myself that, you know, if I'm mostly getting it, it's doing something. Yeah.
Yeah. The ones that I all use are like 30 to 45. And the thing is, I'm sure if I spent some time with it, I could figure out what they all have in common, but it's not.
Are they all physical or?
I think they are all physical, but it's like, I've tried a lot of physical sunscreens that also give me rashes. And so I don't know what the difference is,
thing to point out is basically what is the difference between a physical and a chemical sunscreen. And so there's an article on Refinery29 that we will post in the wrap up to this episode, but they basically say physical sunscreen deflects the sun rays while chemical sunscreen absorbs them. So physical sunscreen usually has zinc in it, and that's what's doing the protecting. So that's what's keeping the sun from actually hitting your skin.
But the double-edged sword there is that the zinc is always leaves a little bit of a white tint on your skin.
Yes.
And the Supergoop of the three of the ones that I just mentioned, I think leaves the least residue. Yeah. But once you start sweating, it does come through. Like the white becomes exaggerated. So the thing that I do is I put on the sunscreen first, and then on top of it, I put Josie Maran bronzing argan oil, which is a product
all over your face,
all over my face. I'm obsessed with it, and it basically like balances out the white from that's the white residue from the sunscreen. But I would use it even if I wasn't wearing the sunscreen because everybody knows that the Josie Maran argan oil is amazing, great product. But B, I just really like it as a bronzer because I think it looks more natural than like a powder bronzer. So I love this product. For some reason, it's really hard to find. Sephora doesn't carry it anymore.
Is it HSN now?
So my last one I got on HSN. I think
HSN has all the Josie Maran you could ever want.
Exactly. So I think that they were maybe going to like discontinue it or something, and then HSN was like, we're keeping exclusive on it.
Yeah.
Who knows? That's my theory. But this is an amazing product, and especially if you are someone who uses zinc-based sunscreens, just put it on over to sort of wash that whiteness away.
The zinc-based sunscreen that I use is a Hourglass Mineral Veil, which is
people
a primer.
So it's an SPF in the primer.
Yeah, but so the one problem is the SPF is only 15, which I don't think is enough, which is why I kind of double layer something on top of it, like the setting mist. But it is really good. It feels really silky smooth when it goes on, nice. And basically what it does is it keeps you from ever feeling like you have that melting face situation in the summer in this weather, which does
dry
feel like
skin
a July
out,
specific thing.
Because I always feel like primers dry my skin out.
Not noticeably for me, but I have so many other skin question marks that it's very hard to really say. The one thing, so in addition to the sunscreens you use, or that we use, that one of the big questions is, why aren't there more sunscreen options in America?
Totally. Besides the fact that we all love being tan.
Well, no, but so do Europeans.
True.
Yeah.
True story.
So apparently, there's a really good article on Racked that we will also link to that basically talks about how the last time that a new sunscreen ingredient was approved in the U.S. was in 2002, which is when we met.
Yeah.
Which is 13 years ago. That's just way too long.
Right.
And apparently there are 8 different ingredients that have been waiting for FDA approval for over 10 years. And all of these ingredients have been passed by different European and Asian nations have gotten approved. And it's not that our ingredients are better or that our ingredients are safer or anything like that. It's just that we are really, really far behind.
Why is that?
Because of the way that the FDA basically is processing these claims.
Which is weird because you read about them like giving these crazy like fast track processing to all these pharmaceutical companies.
Correct. So in November, Congress passed a Sunscreen Innovation Act to push things along because it's becoming this issue where, you know, skin cancer rates have risen, melanoma, all of this stuff. And there are products and ingredients out there that are doing a better job or that can, you know, be used in conjunction with things that are already approved that we don't have access to. So a lot of people buy sunscreen when they're coming back, you know, from vacation at like duty free shops or whatever. Like Vichy is one of the lines that people really love. And so that's also something to really dive into.
One thing that I want to bring up before we finish up this segment that I totally forgot about until recently is something you told me, which was a story about the mother of a friend of yours who always wears metal frame sunglasses, Ray-Bans mostly, are always like this, and ended up getting like crazy sunspots right around
her face. You can't
see, but I'm pointing to my face
right
now where it would happen. because, if you're wearing metal frame sunglasses, which I personally love, they're going to
reflect the light off
your skin and magnify it. So I still wear metal frame sunglasses, but when I'm at the beach, I try to wear the plastic or like
that's a really good
ones.
Call.
Yeah.
That's a really
because
good call.
You told me that and I was like, that makes total sense. It's basically like holding tinfoil up to your face.
Exactly. No, it's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
Should we we don't have too much time before our next
guest.
Let's
jump into Lauren, and then we can come back if we have time to talk about.
Let's do it. I have one thing I want to say before. This is a surprise shout out. I am hobbling around today like a crazy person because I pulled a muscle, and I want to give a big shout out to Sherpa.
Yes. We wanted to talk about Sherpa on this show no matter what anyway, so may as well do it now.
Yeah. So if I'm sounding a little off today, it's because I'm in so much pain because I pulled a weird muscle and then ignored it for a while until yesterday morning I woke up and couldn't walk.
And you think it's like sports injury related, running related.
Exactly.
Possibly.
Yeah. Okay. It's most likely related to running. And my husband was like, okay, let's go to the emergency room, which to me sounded like my worst nightmare. I was like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to sit around for hours. I don't actually know what it is. I just want someone. I want a doctor. Like, I want a real doctor. Yeah. But it's New York. I don't actually have a primary care physician. I just have my gyno.
Well,
I was
and
like,
a
I'm
prompt
not
care
call
is
gyno.
Not an easy to come by situation.
Yeah. So we are so lucky that we have it of a kind. We are so lucky that we've given this gift to ourselves that we subscribe to a service called Sherpa. And Sherpa is a company that sort of, we always say it sort of sits on top of your health insurance. So they have two primary functions. One, they have a lot of doctors who you can call and or send pictures to or email, and they will consult you if you send them a picture of like a weird growth and you're like, what is this thing? Do I need to see a doctor? You're like, my throat hurts. They'll be like, okay, that's definitely strep. I'm going to write you a prescription. They can do a lot of stuff. They're real doctors. They also have a whole arm of their business that deals with crazy insurance claims, which as everyone knows are a nightmare. And you do it all over email or through their app. Mm-hmm. You can also call them, and they're pretty much always available. And
the response time is insane how quickly they get back to you.
It's amazing. And Eric and I have both had so many experiences where it's just like, I have a medical thing right now. It's not going to make sense, or it's going to take too long for me to go to my real doctor, but the emergency room is not the right call at this point. So I called Sherpa yesterday morning and I was like, I can't walk. I'm freaking out. And Dr. Susan Ganella, who is my favorite doctor there, and not
Claire's
just because she's
Dr.
so
Susan
pretty
Brunella
and chic.
And has pretty skin.
She has great skin. I've never met her in real life, just seen her picture on the internet. She called me back immediately and was like, okay, this sounds serious. And was like, I'm going to get you an appointment. 5 minutes later, calls me back. I'm crying because I'm so scared and in so much pain. And she's super, like, kind and understanding. And she's like, listen, Dr. Goldstein's an old friend of mine. He's like senior most person in this practice at NYU, and he's an orthopedic surgeon. They're expecting you now. Get in a cab and go. It was the most VIP treatment to just be like, call someone and be like, I can't walk this is really hurting. And to have them be like, okay, I made you an appointment, go with this super senior person. It was insane.
And the idea behind Sherpa is basically that by giving this to your employees, you're preventing them from having to spend a lot of time in a doctor's office calling in sick days, you know, basically giving them access to the care that they need or that they can get. And, you know, lest you think they're just like overprescribing antibiotics or something via an app, they send these really involved questionnaires. Yep. If you do say that you think you have strep or a UTI or some very regular treatable condition. And if there are any questions around it at all, they recommend someone for you to go see or another test to take but they just make it very easy. You know, they have an app that works on your phone. I was traveling in April and had something come up that I needed a prescription for. And I was in Seattle and had no idea where to go and didn't want to spend a full day of my vacation dealing with what was a very minor thing. And it was resolved between picking up the rental car and checking into the hotel.
That is amazing. And that's how healthcare should be. And it's so true that if not for Sherpa, you would have spent the entire day dealing
100%.
With that. Yeah. And it's so amazing. At this point, honestly, can't imagine my life without it. And it's exactly what Erica said. I can remember so many times employees of ours would have definitely taken like a full day off to deal with an illness or would have had to leave in the middle of the day to deal with a doctor, which is fine. People should do that. But ultimately, it saves you as an employer.
But when it's necessary.
Yeah, exactly. It saves you as an employer so much time and money, and also saves you as a user so much time and money when you're like, listen, like, I get UTIs. I know what UTIs are. I have one now. So can you just call me in a prescription? Like or pink eye or whatever it is, these things that take up so much time. And you're like, I actually just need someone to write me a prescription.
Yes. As far as I know, Sherpa is only available in New York currently, I think. But if you own or work for a small business in New York, definitely definitely consider this. There's basically a flat monthly fee for each member of your team that uses it. So if there's someone on your team who never once asks a question, then you're not charged for them. You're only charged for the employees who actually
take
advantage
of the
service.
Right, because it only starts charging you once the person on your team asks.
Exactly. And it's spelled S-H-E-R-P-A-A.
And I will say, even though it's only available in New York, it's like so, New York is the perfect use case for it because it is so, it's so hard. You know, you call a doctor and they're like, cool, so we'll see you in 3 months.
Exactly.
So yeah, I can't say enough good things about it, especially after my experience yesterday.
Absolutely. All right. Well, let's hop to commercial and get back and talk to Lauren. See you soon.
This is called Sunday Night Chicks by Mamarazzi. We will be right back.
Visit a farm. Log on to escapemaker.com for more ideas on local weekend getaways and day trips, including orchards, farms, and wineries. Or come by Escape Maker's Yellow Tent in Grow NYC's Green Markets and pick up a guide to local agritourism escapes to the Green Market's own farmers and producers. The guide will be updated seasonally to feature farms, wineries, and destinations in New York City, New York State, New Jersey, Vermont, and Pennsylvania. Plus, Escape Maker will offer overnight packages to these destinations so you can get the full experience. No car? No problem. Escape Maker features plenty of ideas for car-free getaways, including discounts via Amtrak. There's no better time to explore outside the city. Fresh air and scenery like a butterfly, and support your local farmer. Log on to escapemaker.com to get inspired and make your escape through the net.
Hello, and welcome back to A Few Things with Claire and Erica, where we talk about all of our favorite obsessions, all the things that are on our mind and that we think you should have on your mind, too. And today we have a very special guest returning for her second appearance here on A Few Things, Lauren Sherman, who is a fashion journalist who is an expert in, I think, tying fashion into current events and things that actually matter politically and economically. And, you know, she writes about other things too, but I think where Lauren really excels and where she's really like unparalleled is talking about things, how fashion impacts all of us. And so one of the things that I was curious about, and I texted Lauren one day and I was like, what do you know about the Trans-Pacific Partnership? Can you explain it to me? Because I had seen that Nike was feeling super passionate about it getting passed, that New Balance was really anti, and I was like, I need somebody to break this down for me.
What does this actually mean?
Exactly. So Lauren obviously jumped right on it. And Lauren, what is the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
Oh man.
And why should we care?
Yeah.
It's pretty complicated, and it's really complicated for American-based businesses, whether or not they produce here or not. But so everybody knows what NAFTA is.
Yeah, and that's what I keep hearing it being compared to.
It's kind of, so NAFTA is North American Free Trade Agreement. NAFTA is basically, in 1994, I believe, they kind of, when you trade, when you do business with another country, when you sell products, whether that's a strap for a shoe or an actual shoe, there are a lot of taxes, tariffs, custom taxes connected to the purchase of these products. So that drives up the price that the consumer pays for the product. What NAFTA did was it cut out a lot of those tariffs between Mexico, the U.S., and Canada. This, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is doing something similar, but with 12 countries, and a lot of them are in Asia.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So Australia, Japan, Vietnam, there's a lot. China is not included, but it is going to affect things because some stuff like the knitwear will be made in China, but then actually sewn together in Vietnam.
Right.
And China and Vietnam might have a better agreement than China and the U.S. has. So
it gets sort of flagged as a Vietnamese product.
Exactly. And so eventually the idea is the people who are for it, which is really big companies that produce overseas, essentially.
Like Nike makes most of their stuff in Vietnam, right?
Exactly. Okay. Yes. The reason they're for it is because they say that it's going to allow them to make more money and make more product and also allow them to sell things for cheaper.
And then the sort of logical extension to this argument is then create more jobs in the United States because they're doing better as a company.
Exactly. And
this
also,
is the sell, at least. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Nike committed, right? They said, we'll create 10,000 more jobs or something like that.
And they also say the other thing that they're saying and what the government is saying is that companies that do produce in the U.S. are also going to benefit from this. So take something like Red Wing Boots. They produce, I think, 80% of their stuff in the U.S.
In Minnesota, right?
Yes, in Minnesota and I think Idaho or something. Okay. They have another factory. But they produce all of their fancy shoes here. They do produce some stuff overseas, but that's all their workwear that actually people wear on, like, oil rigs and stuff. Okay. But their boots, their $250 boots.
Because they're, like, a workwear boot company that has become hashtag menswear.
Exactly.
Heritage brand.
And they're growing rapidly overseas. They have a huge following in Japan.
Okay.
So, and a lot of American brands do. Right now, when you sell something in Japan, it's much more expensive because of all the taxes and tariffs.
Brands sell in Japan, it's more expensive. Okay.
Yeah. So what a lot of these companies, and I can't speak for Red Wing, I haven't talked to them about this specifically, but what the government is saying and what they're saying that the company should feel is excited that suddenly this is going to open up a lot of markets. I just talked to someone from this trade organization called the American Apparel and Footwear Association about this. And he essentially said, you know, a huge majority of consumer purchases are made outside of the U.S. Even though we do a lot, there's a lot of potential to sell U.S. goods outside of the U.S. Mm-hmm. And this will help that along. Now,
you may not know the answer to this, but does that apply specifically to brick and mortar, or if Red Wing has a big e-commerce shop and they are selling to Japanese customers, does it also help in that sense?
You know what? I think that probably varies by company because of if you look at, I know I've experienced this by shopping with UK companies. Mm-hmm. When they first get their web off the ground, they charge a lot for customs. Mm-hmm. And then eventually they waive those fees and they take on those fees. Okay. So if Red Wing is taking on those fees when they ship to Japan, if they do ship to Japan, I think they probably don't. Because they probably have a license in Japan that handles all the e-commerce there. Okay. But if they did, then yes, it may save them money. It might not be something that the consumer
would notice.
But in general, the thought is that they should be able to lower their prices a bit. So if a pair of boots are $250 here, and right now people in Japan are paying $350, maybe they can lower it to $300 after exchange rates and all that stuff.
So what are people who are opposed to the TPP saying?
So they don't believe that that's true and that you know, the only 2% or 2.5% of products that we buy currently are made here, made in the U.S., which is so crazy. And they just think that this isn't going to help that and that all this kind of buzz around Made in America products may go away because it's going to become what started to happen. And hopefully I'm not blathering on too much.
No, this is really super interesting to me.
Toward the Made in America.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a really complicated topic.
But I think it's so interesting. And I think it, like, most consumers aren't really thinking about it, but it actually is going to have a huge impact on
it. It could. Essentially what has started to happen is, in China is not as cheap as it used to be to produce goods because their facilities have gotten better. Their wages have gone up.
Okay.
Everything, by making something in China, it looks really nice. 40 years ago, made in China stuff was real, real not nice.
Okay, this is a good, this is a good time for me to interrupt you, because part of my understanding of the Trans-Pacific Partnership was that it was, and this is maybe reductionist a bit, but that it was sort of created in response to, if we don't do this, China's going to overtake us as an economic powerhouse.
I think that that is what the government is saying. And, you know, companies like Nike, I was just in Portland. Nike is their economy.
Right.
Everyone works there. That's what drives it. Nike is a huge, huge, huge business. And obviously those people have lobbyists and they have a lot of influence in Washington. And so I think that that's part of it as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why, you know, it hasn't been, and I'm not a super political person, but I have really watched this. And while more Republicans are favoring this, there were, you know, it just got passed in Congress to fast track the decision to whether or not we're going to be in it. It's going to happen. Like, we're going to be a part of this partnership.
Okay.
And at first there was a worry that not enough Democrats would agree to it, but enough have.
Okay.
And I think part of that is because of President Obama's support of it. But also, it's complicated, and it's just a very, it could end up meaning very little. It could end up meaning a lot. If you look at NAFTA, I was just looking at how much was made in America before NAFTA and how much was made afterward.
Oh, yeah.
And that number in 1993, I think that 52%, no, 1995, 52% of goods were made here. This year, 2.5%.
Wow.
But,
and that's goods that were consumed in America or goods in all of the world?
Goods that were made here that people bought
here.
Yes. So
that's crazy, and that's attributable to NAFTA.
Well, no, and that's the thing. A lot of
correlation,
people say
not
that.
Causality. Yeah,
but if you look back 20 more years, it basically started in the 70s, and there was actually a huge Made in America kind of push in the 1970s as well. But it started in the 70s when China, I think, regulations lifted a bit, and they started getting into manufacturing.
Okay.
And we started buying goods from them.
Okay.
And so every year before 1994, it got smaller. And I think in 1960, and can't quote me on that, but I did write a story about this on Monday on Fashionista. But I think in 1960 or 1964, around there, 98% of the goods, the apparel that we bought was made here.
Wow. And that's amazing.
And it's crazy. In the 80s, it was like 70%, but it just slowly went down.
But what you're saying is that likely has more to do with opening up trade with China than it does specifically to NAFTA.
Exactly. I think that a lot of local people, you know, smaller designers might not agree with that, because it's just like the sentiment around NAFTA. But I think at this point there is so little made here anyway, that I don't know. I think that it may affect it. It may not. There might be enough interest around, you know, what a lot of the main American designers talk about is that, you know, we are really obsessed with where our food comes from, and how the food movement kind of will start correlating more to fashion, and that more people will care about where their fashion comes from. I don't think it'll ever be on the same scale, but I do think that that's probably true. And so the numbers of what's made in America have been creeping up very, very slowly, you know, by like eighths of percentage points. But I think that that may still keep going. I'm not sure how much this is going to affect that. But again,
what we're seeing a lot of, interestingly, in our designers, you know, we have certainly a group of designers that we work with who are very dedicated and proud of the fact that they produce in America, and a lot of them produce here in New York. But we also have a growing group of designers that we work with who produce a lot, very often in South America specifically, who in really poor countries where they're using the crafts that are sort of endemic to these places to make these things and giving jobs to these artisans who wouldn't otherwise have them. So
especially women.
Yes. And so you're starting to see, so it's also, I would say it's mostly in Africa and in South America where we most often see this, but you see this whole movement to say, we are creating this at an accessible price point by doing it in Africa or South America. But in doing so, we're also empowering, which is a word that, you know, who knows what that means, but we're economically empowering, right? These women who have these special skills, and we're giving them the opportunity to have a little bit of economic independence by producing here in these other countries. And so I think, you know, you're starting to see the development of arguments being made that are not anti-made in America, but saying there's also
it's not the only option.
Yeah, and there's something progressive about not always producing in America. There's other options too that you can feel good about.
Can we take a second and talk about Made in America and how it's defined? You just wrote an article for Fashionista about that this week.
Yes, and it's extremely confusing. So I was on the phone with a lawyer from the Federal Trade Commission all day on Monday.
That's trying, amazing.
And it was just, everything was like, yes, but, yes, but. So one of the issues with this whole Made in America movement is a lot of the stuff shouldn't actually be labeled Made in America. Mm-hmm. Like, if the FTC found out, these companies would get in trouble. Now, one of the things a lawyer I talked to said, one that does not work for the FTC, is that the FTC doesn't have time to kind of go after these smaller brands. But here's an issue that I talked to this one designer, super, super proud of the fact that they produce in the U.S. They have hired, you know, a team of 50 to hand sew these bags. They're beautifully done. They're, you know, people from age 20 to age 60 work at this company. The bags are, you know, not cheap, mm-hmm. but they're really well done, and they're really proud of the fact that they've made these jobs for artisans and people with skills that maybe didn't have anywhere to use them before. Problem is that their leather is not from here. Their leather is imported from South America.
Right.
And it comes in raw, and they use it because it's the best value, mm-hmm. and it makes the most sense. But unfortunately, because of the way these rules work, even though they transform the leather, it still should say something like made in the USA of raw imported goods, raw
right.
imported leather. Or
so
imported.
It's constructed in America, really, is what,
yes.
and there's not a lot of
and
definition around
and
how
have,
to, yeah.
Yeah, and you have to use a qualifier.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but the other thing is, it's all by a case-by-case basis,
right.
So.
Well, because you even got into, like, is the yarn, are the raw materials from the yarn imported, but the yarn is spun here? Because that makes a difference,
and
right?
Yeah. With textiles, they have a little more leeway.
Okay.
So, which is interesting too. So, because they're, so one example is Natalie Channon, the designer of Alabama Channon, who does everything locally. She makes couture dresses in Alabama locally, but she also produces a line of t-shirts that are kind of mid-price. She really wants to make everything here, and she does use cotton harvested in Texas that's spun in North Carolina, but that's for medium weight t-shirts.
Okay.
For very thin, lightweight t-shirts, which is what we all make, there are literally no machines in the U.S. that can spin that kind of cotton. So
there become real limitations around what you can even produce.
Exactly.
If you want everything to be 100% made in America.
Exactly. So she imports that yarn from Turkey, and then it is knit here. So textiles, there's some rule called the textile fiber rule, and there's the specific clause in it that's it's called the one step back.
Mm-hmm.
Rule or clause or whatever it's called. The lawyers were very specific,
but we're not lawyers.
Semantics. But it's, if you, essentially it means that as long as it was knit here, it's okay. It has to go, you have to look at the step before it. And,
right.
and because of that, if it had been, if the fabric came, you know, in a square here, and then it was cut and sewn here, it would not be okay to label it made in America, which is, you know, when you're a young startup, and if you're, even if you're producing t-shirts at a factory in LA, that's something that you're proud of, that you're creating jobs here. You know, I looked into American Apparel because I was like, wow, they actually spin all their yarn here.
Oh, interesting.
Which I mean, well, they used to. I can't confirm for the last.
I wouldn't
six
have
months,
guessed that though.
Yeah. I didn't. They have spinning and dyeing mills, so it is a really it's a really complicated problem. There are people who have advocates who want to loosen the regulations mm-hmm. so that we can say more things are made here, which actually would boost all those figures and right. kind of, you know, just create more
pride.
Yeah. And yeah. probably more conversation around what you can produce here.
Right.
But unfortunately, they get reviewed every 10 years and they were just reviewed, I think, in 2012. Mm-hmm. So there really aren't going to be many changes. And also, how far do you go? Mm-hmm. Because there are people that are certainly labeling things made in America, but they really aren't, and it's not okay. And so it's just where do you cross the line? So right now the line is really tight, but it also
relies a lot on self-policing yeah. since the FTC isn't going to step in.
Yeah. Yeah. Any small designer. Yeah. I think one thing that I think is so interesting and sort of the most compelling sort of story that I've heard around Made in America recently is if you think about it, when you think about Made in America and the garment centers in the United States or all over the country, there's a ton, obviously, there used to be a ton of manufacturing in the Midwest, but fashion specifically always really prided itself on the garment district in New York City, mm-hmm. which is a city that has changed dramatically in the last 30 years and is now a really expensive place to do anything, live, have a business, anything. And there has been some effort more recently to revive the garment district and to say, like, let's bring this back to New York. Let's like make clothes in New York and let's get government funds to support a true garment district again. Mm-hmm. But if you step back and you take a second and you're like, I really want to bring back manufacturing to United States, why would you do it in New York, which is one of the most expensive cities in the country? And one of the sort of responses that we've seen to this is a designer that we work with a lot, Caroline Hurley, has been involved in an effort to revive an old manufacturing town in Massachusetts called New Bedford.
It's actually where there was an interesting BuzzFeed long form mm-hmm. article about this city last year, because the original Madewell mm-hmm. that the current Madewell bought its name from was based there.
Right. So Madewell, before it was a company owned by J. Crew, was a workwear company that all of the products were manufactured in New Bedford, because New Bedford was a thriving clothes manufacturing town. And with all of the changes that we've just been talking about and manufacturing moving overseas, it became a really desolate town, destroyed by poverty and drugs, really. And there's now a lot of very skilled but poor people living there, a lot of immigrants.
Well, or even not necessarily. I mean, I think a lot of the people have to be really trained, but yes. people who want to work, who want yes. to be doing something with their hands, who want to be creating things and having a fulfilling job that they maybe couldn't otherwise find in New
exactly.
Bedford.
Exactly. And there are no That's jobs true. There. There are really very few jobs there. So what Caroline Hurley and some of her colleagues have done have started training the people who live in New Bedford to do the woodblock printing that she uses on her textiles, and to sew the hems on all of her textiles. And they're basically opening factories in New Bedford, and they're able to do it at competitive pricing because it's a town where the cost of living is pretty low as compared to New York City, where the cost of living is astronomical. So I'm really interested in seeing innovative models like that that keep manufacturing in the United States, but do it in a way that's not sort of stuck in this nostalgia of doing
of
it necessarily.
Of what it used to
exactly,
be.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That just doesn't apply anymore in 2015.
Exactly.
I also think something that people don't realize about Made in New York is a lot of designers, when they first start out on the high end, mm-hmm. make everything here and they're really proud of it. Mm-hmm. But eventually the quality mm-hmm.
It's hard to scale in New York.
It's really hard mm-hmm. to scale. And so they end up going to Italy.
Yep.
And at some point they are advised, you need to go to Italy to get the quality up. And yep. and that's not to say you can't get a beautifully made garment here. Mm-hmm. But it's just much more difficult because there just aren't enough people with the skills. And there still are in Italy. So that's something that people just don't, at some point, I'm made in America. And then suddenly all these people are advising you, you need to start making more at higher quality. You have to go to Italy, not even China or wherever.
Right.
So that's an interesting factor too.
Well, and the great thing about making it in New York when you first start out is that you're really close to it. And as a young designer, being yeah. able to be really close to the product and confirming.
It's a huge quality yeah. control
exactly.
mechanism.
It's the quality control.
All right. On that note, we have gone significantly over. We should go.
We should go.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much for listening. We love our listeners. And we last week announced that we wanted to hear your ideas, your questions, your thoughts about what you want us to talk about. And we got some great responses, which we're going to address in the coming weeks. But if you also have questions for us that you want us to talk, things you want us to talk about on air, email us at info@ofakind.com. And in the meantime, I want to thank Jack, our engineer, Jack Inslee, who's amazing and puts up with us going way over time. Please subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher and leave us a comment because that is really helpful. That's what.
Oh, we would read the crap out of those comments.
We would read the crap. We love a comment.
Especially a nice comment.
Yeah. Mean ones we will discard during our morning meditation. But the nice ones we will put in our hearts and keep them there forever. Thank you also to our sponsor.
EscapeMakers.com.
Yes. And coming up next, you're going to hear a short clip from the fantastic Aaron Fairbanks talking about seafood with Rick Moonen.
Stay tuned.
That's the show.
The new technology is study what nature does and emulate it. You know, so they're and so next to these fish farms, they're growing kelp, and they're farming kelp, and they're farming mussels next to that. Super healthy because a lot of nutrients come out of the byproducts of the farming, you know.
Chef Rick Moonen knows his seafood. The proprietor of Rick Moonen's RM Seafood and R Bar Cafe in the Mandalay Bay in Las Vegas chatted with Heritage Radio Network Executive Director Aaron Fairbanks for a special interview.
I too was a member of the voice that said farm raised salmon was bad, and you know what? First of all, let's understand aquaculture or farm raising, same thing. It's fairly new, you know, and very necessary. More than half of what we consume globally right now comes from farms, and I don't think that's going to change. You know, we've done a really good job of overfishing the most popular species. Right. There's a lot out there that aren't popular. That if we could diversify our diet, it would take the pressure off of those wild species to come back. But in the world of aquaculture, a lot of changes have been made over the last 5 to 10 years. You know, they've learned, you know, because there's you know, when you put a lot of fish, a large concentration of fish in a small area, there's a lot of stress. You know, imagine packing the heck out of an elevator.
Yeah, like any population.
And a guy in the back sneezes and everybody's sick, you know. So that same type of thing is going to happen when there's a stressed out situation. And so antibiotics have to be used in the feed in order to keep them healthy and protect your investment. Escapes happen. You know, they get out and all of a sudden you've got all these fish that didn't really belong in that area in the first place competing for food that the fish that belong there in the first place need to survive. It creates an imbalance in the ecosystem. And for me, that's really what it's all about. Maintaining a healthy environment creates good food, you know, healthy water, healthy fish.
For this entire interview and more of the best food radio on the planet, visit heritageradionetwork.org. This piece was brought to you by the International Culinary Center, culinarycenter.com.